continue from there.
Thank you. Thank you. First of all, thank you to Roy for inviting me to this very stimulating conference. And as I'm sure many of you know, the thinking about the conversion of the Icelanders has very much relied on Ari Fróði's account written in the early 12th century, and practically all the debate which has taken place on this has revolved around this single narrative. And even archaeological debate until very recently has very much been aimed at either trying to prove or disprove what Ari says. However, in the last 10 to 15 years, we have seen a great number of new finds relating to early Christianity in Iceland, which allows us to construct new narratives, look at these things in a different way, not so much in conflict with Ari's account, but rather we are seeing new aspects of what was happening, and that's what I want to talk you. What do I do?
The arrow.
Which one?
This one.
Ah. So here is just an example of a number of churches which have been excavated in the North Atlantic in recent years. Sandur here in the Faroes in the early 70s, but most of these are from the last 10 years. And I'm not going to go through all the details here, but you can see that there are similarities. These are small structures, and they are associated with burials. And when we do have evidence for enclosures, they are, as a rule, circular. And the dating of these sites is turning out to be pretty consistent. We now have in Iceland alone more than 15 church and Christian cemetery sites with firm pre-1100 dates, and most of these firm dates we can say they are firm because these remains are below a tephra layer from 1104, and in four of these cases we have good radiocarbon and stratigraphic evidence that these churches are built just before or around 1000 at the Skeljastadir, Thorarinsstadir, Hofstadir, and Neðriás, and these are in the south and the east and the west, so there doesn't seem to be any the south, north, and east, there doesn't seem to be any geographical variation here, and the suspicion is, or the implication is, that the rest of these sites are also from the early part of the 11th century, at least, if not before. It is interesting when we look at this collection of sites that they are quite similar to each other, and the biggest issue here is the small size of these buildings. They are all uniformly less than 25 square meters, most of them between 10 and 20, and later we get much larger churches. But the earliest of these, which have been excavated, the one in Reykholt, is probably from the late 11th century, although firm results are not available yet from that just recently concluded excavation. They are all associated with burial. They have circular churchyard, as I mentioned, and they are located in the farmyard. They are closely associated with the dwellings of the farms, in contrast to earlier pagan burial custom. there is a little bit of variation in the construction of detail. There is variation in how they are built. Some of them you can call stave churches. Others are more conventional turf timber combination buildings, and they will have looked a little bit different. There are two main types. Most of them will have looked similar to this reconstruction of a Danish 11th century church in Herning, in Jutland, but a few, at least two, are more like the one in Stöng, which will have not looked very dissimilar from secular architecture. But however, in plan, they look pretty much the same. But these these distinctions are potentially interesting, but at the moment the pattern don't make particular sense, at least not to me. There's no clear association between the status of the sites, for instance, and these variations. It doesn't seem that this type of church is necessarily associated with lower status sites, for instance. Another aspect of this is that these buildings seem to have been ubiquitous. We have now registered 1,492 church sites in Iceland, based on all sorts of different evidence. Only a tiny fraction of these are archaeologically attested. These are place names and most importantly, late medieval records, church charters, which record the chapels and annexed churches which belonged to the parishes. And so for many of the parishes, we have lists of these churches, and so that's the biggest part of this evidence. If we look more closely at this sort of data, and I'm not going to bore you with the details here, we can estimate that in the 14th and 15th centuries, there were probably something like 1,800 churches and chapels in the country. So we still have some 200 which we haven't identified. And there is clearly evidence for a decline in the number of these buildings in the 12th and 13th centuries. Many of the excavated examples are churches which were out of use before 1300. And there are incidental references in 13th century sources to churches which don't exist in the 14th and 15th centuries, when we do have the more comprehensive sort of evidence. So possibly there were something like 2,000 to 2,500 churches built in Iceland in the early 11th century. And this is a remarkably high number, I'm sure you will agree with me, considering that there were maybe some 4,000 farms in the country, 4,000 assessed farming units. There were probably somewhat a greater number of households in the 18th century. There are 7,000 households in Iceland. I'm mainly basing this on the Icelandic evidence, simply because there is much more of it than in the Faroes and Greenland. But in general, and I'll come back to this, the Faroes and Greenland seem to have the same sort of pattern, and clearly there is evidence in both Faroes and Greenland of very early small churches. It seems that in the early 11th century, there were a small church was built for at least every other farm in the country, a church for maybe every 20 to 40 persons. So that's a lot of architecture being erected in the North Atlantic. And this seems to confirm what people have thought on other grounds, that Christianity spread very rapidly, and that it spread very comprehensively in the North Atlantic in around 1000. And we can of course ask why. One reason which has been mooted is that paganism was possibly less rooted in these new societies than in the homelands, and that sounds reasonable to me. It is easy to imagine how new societies like this can have a more fertile ground for new ideas and attitudes. It is easier to introduce new things in new societies. Another explanation, which has a long pedigree, is the idea that Christianity was already widespread in these countries, that many of the original settlers in the late 9th century were Christian. That's possible, but the archaeology doesn't really suggest it was. We have very good evidence for pagan burial practice in Iceland down to around 1000, and nothing earlier than the mid 10th century, which can be considered to be Christian. Nevertheless, it is, I think, necessary to keep this in mind. But there is clearly something significant happening around 1000 early in the early 11th century. I think this has to do with identity formation, and I have argued, and I'm not going to bore you with the details here. I'm just going to tell you this, like as if it was the truth, that it's only in the mid to late 10th century that the people inhabiting Iceland and the North Atlantic colonies begin to ascribe to something we can recognize as a Norse ethnic identity. It is striking that in the earliest layers we have of occupation in Iceland from the late 9th and the very early 10th century, the material culture is largely just non-diagnostic. There's nothing ethnic about it, neither the architecture nor the artifacts we find, and most of it just don't find very much in terms of artifacts, and what there is non-specific. And then in the sort of after 925-30, we begin to see expressions of identity, quite clear ones, and an increase in sort of symbolically bearing artifacts in the graves, and it's only in the in this period that we begin to have these the halls with curved long walls, for instance, which are typical of Scandinavian architecture in this period. Before that, the vernacular architecture is completely different and mainly sort of sunken featured buildings, rather nondescript. So it seems to me that whatever the origins of the people who settled the North Atlantic, which may have been varied, the sort of identity formation is taking place in the second to third generations in the mid 10th century. And my suggestion is that Christianity comes as a second layer of identity for these people who are worried about these things. They are sort of thinking about who they are and what is our society supposed to be like. And Christianity offers a sense of modernity and inclusion, of course, in Europe. Possibly they were aware that the spread of Christianity in Scandinavia was sluggish, if you like, and maybe they liked being more modern than the areas they came from. And we certainly have such parallels in more recent times. but also I think it is the building of these sort of churches, which clearly are symbolically laden acts, they symbolize a will to, opt into this new ideology, which also is a way to express common ground and cohesion. And this is, of course, parallels Arifrodi's story, which is about the conversion, which is not really a story about the glory of God. It's about a people deciding or preferring unity over division, and it seems that the ubiquitous building of these small churches is expressing the same sort of will to be the same. And we can see this also in terms of peer polity interaction, keeping up with the Joneses. If everyone is doing it, you have to do it yourself. But that's not it's not the only possible way to behave, and it is significant that people chose to behave in that way. Interestingly, this does not replace everything that we can at least afterwards define as pagan. And in Hofstadir in northeast Iceland, where a feasting hall built in the mid-10th century has been excavated, there is very clear evidence that there is at least a 50-year overlap between the use of this feasting hall and a church. So we have a feasting hall here, built in the mid-10th century and coming out of use in the mid to late 11th century. It's It's been torn down before 1104. Here, only 100 meters away, there is a church which is probably built before 1000, and then was in use down to the late Middle Ages. And so I used to argue that what was happening in Hofstadir was some sort of pagan reactionism. That this was this is a pretty far sort of this is not a central place in any sense. It's it's pretty out of the way in every sense, it seemed likely that people who sort of didn't want to be Christian and wanted to stress their paganism had a refuge there, and that's how we could explain why they were doing this feasting, and there is a sort of quite un-Christian symbolism associated with it. The outsides of the walls of this hall were decorated with cattle skulls, and there is other evidence there of non-Christian ritual, let's say. But that explanation doesn't hold up, but because this church is clearly built there while the hall is in full operation, and we have to assume that it's unlikely that this was in conflict. It's more likely that it is the same people who are responsible for both structures and what's happening in them. So that suggests to me that the introduction of Christianity in Iceland was not something defined by the people on the ground themselves. They adopted those aspects of it which were useful to them and held on to others which continue to be useful at least for a time. And it is important in this context, of course, again to remember Ari's account. An important aspect of it is that the beginnings of the institutional church seem to take place in the mid 11th century. So the first Icelandic bishop is consecrated in 1056, and it's only after that we begin to see the formation of an institutional church. And it is possibly in that period when people start to frown on the sort of activities that are taking place in this feasting hall. But long before that, the general population had adopted at least aspects of Christianity for its own reasons, and I think we can get a little bit closer to understanding why. And it is interesting to look at the difference, what changes in terms of burial, which is the evidence we can look at. There is a fairly straightforward pagan paradigm of burial. There was a cemetery to every farm, possibly every household. And this graph here, which is maybe not very easy to understand, shows this in here. The sort of the three lines here, which sort of go together, are show the distribution of burials. Or sort of how burials are associated with farms according to their valuation. So these are poor farms and these are rich farms, and the distribution of pagan burial just follows the normal distribution, the distribution of all farms, whereas the distribution of churches is quite different. There are very few churches associated with the smallest and poorest farms, and a lot of them are associated with the richest ones. The largest pagan cemeteries have maybe 10 to 15 graves, most with much fewer, 1 to 5 people, and this is suspiciously small. It should be 10, at least 20 to 30 if everyone who lived in these farms was buried in these cemeteries. And as in Scandinavia and elsewhere, it's clear that a part of the population is missing from these cemeteries. Children are obviously not there. There are only two young children among the pagan graves. There is a low proportion of women, and this is the same as in Norway and in other places. and there's a higher proportion of graves with grave goods than you would expect from what we know of this population. And so, but that also means that this is partly a discovery bias we are looking at. But nevertheless, it is clear that a part of the population is simply not included in these pagan cemeteries. This changes with the introduction of Christian burial. Then we get lots of children buried already in the 11th century, and even proportion of men and women. It seems that everyone is included in these Christian burials. Just quickly to look at how the change manifests itself in the landscape. Here we have an example of a four pagan burial grounds in Berufjörður in northwest Iceland, and this is usually described as a single site, but it is actually four clusters, and each cluster is within the modern boundaries of four different farms, and of course we don't know if the boundaries were the same in the 10th century as they are now, but there is much to suggest that they were. So in here we have a demonstration that there was a pagan cemetery associated with each farm, but we don't have churches associated with all of them. In fact, only one of them, and that's only possibly, in fact. So what happens is that the smaller farms, the poorer farms, they lose their cemeteries. They stop having their own, and they have to take their people to a neighboring farm. We can think sort of whether this was good or bad. There is a lot of ambiguity about people's attitudes to the dead. One interesting aspect of the pagan burials is, or the pagan cemeteries, is that they are, as a rule, out of sight of the farms which they presumably belong to. So there was a, and this can be interpreted as some sort of uneasiness about having dead people very close to you. Clearly, this changes in the Christian paradigm, when you move the cemeteries basically into your farmyard. And then you have the dead people very close to you indeed. But we also have evidence from the 12th and 13th century about all sorts of prejudices about sort of people not wanting to have people they don't know in their cemeteries. So the principle of universal Christian burial was not took a long time to be accepted in Iceland. 14th century, I would say, was the time when that was finally achieved. So, but nevertheless, I think this shows up a fault line which probably pre-existed in this society between the people who have things and those who don't have things. And it reveals a relationship of dependency. And this graph here shows basically the same thing as the other one. These are the pagan burials. They have the same proportion in every size category of the farms, whereas the churches and the chapels are most clearly associated with the bigger ones. So the conversion, I think, sheds light on socioeconomic structures, and this is where my interest in this comes. So I'm using the conversion rather to try to understand society rather than the other way around. And it's clear to me, at least, that the better off farmers, probably the people who owned land, were crucial in this process. They are the group which is critical for the success of this possibly more or less homemade conversion. So it's not apparent that the chieftains, a much smaller group of maybe 20 to 70 people, depending on how you define them, was in any way instrumental in this. It seems rather that they followed on where their clients had interests. And in two of the sites which have been excavated, Hofstadir and Hrísbrú or Mosfell, which are and those are sites which are likely residences of chieftains. The churches they built are no different from the churches built by sort of ordinary landowners, it seems. so we can. This is a big group. This is if we take the number seriously, it's possibly something like half of all the farmers in the country. But this is a group clearly, which can't be suspected of an interest in consolidating their influence over their neighbors and possibly their tenants. and that may be the import of the change that is happening in the around 1000. It's later that you get the introduction of an institutionalized church. Looking at the Faroes and Greenlands, there are differences, and I think these relate to different settlement patterns in these countries. In the Faroes, settlement is much more nucleated. In something like 80 hamlets or bygdir, where according to this model there should have been a church for every single one of them. Later on, when we do have actual counts, they are much fewer. We still don't have good archaeological evidence to support that, but I'll wager it'll come to light. And nevertheless, there will have been a smaller number of churches per population in the Faroes than in Iceland. And in Greenland, there are these big stone churches they built in the 13th and 14th centuries, and a scatter of small churches, but much fewer than in Iceland. And it seems that this reflects the different composition of the Greenlandic society, where there is a comparative absence of middle-sized farmers. Greenlandic society seems to have been much more unequal than Icelandic or the Faroese. Just to show you a nice picture of a burial which was excavated 2 weeks ago. This is a pagan burial in Hrífunes, which is a place which has been producing burials for a long time. And what's interesting here is this is a robbed burial, and this is the robber's trench, which has different colored soil. The interesting part is that this robber, and usually we think that these robbers are sort of late medieval people looking for metal, this robber also redug a post hole. There's a post hole which was part of the original burial, but the robber also... He redug it and placed something in it, and we have seen big advances in our understanding of pagan burial practice in the last few years. There have been large-scale excavations of pagan cemeteries, and one of the interesting things coming out of that is that there are all sorts of things happening around these graves, and there are structures associated with them, post holes around them, and the implication here is that the robber or the people who are taking the bones out, they are doing so not necessarily because they wanted to destroy the burial or get at the metal, but it was a ritual act. And one possibility which the excavator suggested was that this was the Christian descendants of this person who had died before 934, who took out the bones, put them in the Christian cemetery, and left a cross here. Who knows? But that's just to show you that this is all this work in progress. There is still a lot happening in Icelandic archaeology, and I'm sure in a few years I will be able to tell you a different story. Thank you.